crystal with him. What is that? Okay. This is from Lawrence Labor, dated Friday, June 15th, 1923. The heading is Justice? ? In the Steel Trust State. Pennsylvania court, after 4 years, frees the murderers of Fanny Sellens, one gunman fugitive from justice. A report has just been broadcasted throughout the country from Pittsburgh that the gunmen who murdered Fanny Sellens, an organizer for the United Mine Workers, in 1919, have been acquitted by a jury. The verdict proves that Gary still rules Pennsylvania and is an effective climax to his recent arguments in favor of the 12-hour day that still prevails in the steel mill. I was in Pittsburgh during the first weeks of the steel strike and personally investigated the foul killing of Fanny Sellens. The report I wrote at that time for the Voice of Labor is reprinted here today because it is the simple truth of one of the foulest atrocities in the long record of crimes committed against labor by the employing class in this country, and should never be forgotten by the workers of this country. On the bulletin board in the OBU headquarters at 51 Newbury Street is a picture of Fanny Sellens as she lay in the morgue that every worker in Lawrence should see and remember. On the same bulletin is also a picture of one of her murderers, John Pearson, alias Davis. The picture of Pearson was recently sent out by the Chief of Police of New Kensington, PA, with a description and the information that he is wanted to stand trial for that murder. Pearson was out on bail and, fearing that Gary might fail in his defense, jumped his bond. Two of his companions in the crime, Manison and Riley, are the ones who have just been acquitted after nearly 4 years of effort on the part of Mrs. Sellens' friends and relatives to bring them to justice. Read this story. Come up to headquarters and look at these pictures and remember. Riley, who has been acquitted, is the thug described in the first paragraphs of this report and identified by witnesses as the one who shot the old miner, Strezel Lecky, as he lay wounded in the road. Is any further comment necessary to prove that there is a class war raging in America and that the workers must organize for their own defense? Reprinted from the Voice of Labor, October 15, 1919. The Brackenridge Atrocity by Ben Leger. And then I saw that man there run up to Strzelecki as he lay face downward in the road and, holding his gun down close, fire deliberately into the old man's back. As the witness spoke, he rose from his chair and pointed toward the rear of the courtroom. I followed the direction of his finger and saw a big, beefy, red-faced thug squirming uncomfortably in his seat. His face went pale, then flushed again as he forced a short, nervous laugh while his eyes shifted about everywhere but in the direction of the accusing finger. It was in the courtroom of Coroner Jameson in Pittsburgh on Friday, September 26th, and the witness, James Oates, organizer for the United Mine Workers of America, was testifying at the inquest being held to determine responsibility for the deaths of Joe Strzelecki, a miner, and Mrs. Fanny Sellens, an organizer, who were killed near Brackenridge, Pennsylvania, on August 26th. The day before, I had been to Brackenridge and West Natrona, where the shooting occurred. I went there wondering whether the details of the terrible tragedy, as I had heard them, could be true. But I know now that the strongest words we have are too weak to adequately convey the truth of this thing to those who have never come in contact with the kind of men the Steel Trust and the Coal Kings use to keep their slaves in subjection. The impression one would get from a report that two people had been killed and five others wounded, some of them shot two or three times, is that the conditions at Brackenridge must have been something bordering on civil war. After my day on the scene and the day in the coroner's court, I came away soul-sick with the unfortunate truth that there was no war, that there was not even resistance to the cold-blooded massacre. There is a bare hill beside the Allegheny River, about halfway between Brackenridge and Natrona. On this hillside at West Natrona, there is a handful of shacks inhabited by the workers of the Allegheny Coal and Coke Company's mine just over the brow of the hill. The mine supplies the plant of the Allegheny Steel Company down beside the river with coal and is controlled by that corporation. The road from Brackenridge to Natrona runs just below the little village where perhaps 100 families live. Another road runs over the hilltop to the mine, and on the corner is a little country store kept by Jewish people. All the miners on the hill are Polish. They had been on strike 6 weeks previous to the shooting, and no trouble of any kind had occurred. Sheriff Haddock of Pittsburgh had sent out 17 deputies armed with riot guns, revolvers, clubs, and blackjacks to protect the property of the coal company. The deputies patrolled the roads between the mine mouth and the Allegheny Steel Company's mill. It was dull work for such deputies. Fanny Sellens, whose home was in New Kensington, a few miles away on the other side of the river, was dividing her time between organizing work for the steelworkers and looking after the interests of the strikers at West Natrona. A reporter for the New Kensington Star, who often accompanied her on her visits to the strikers, has stated that at no time did she say or do anything to provoke the hostility of the deputies, though often subjected to insults from them in passing. By going over the ground and talking with people who were there at the time, many of whom testified next day in the courtroom, I was able to get a very clear story of the events of August 26th. It is a story that has to be put together from the testimony of many people in order to be thoroughly understood. Most of the strikers who were on the hill that afternoon are still stunned by the suddenness and incomprehensible brutality of it all. They all have vivid impressions of the things they saw and heard, but they cannot understand why it all happened. Two facts that came out in the coroner's courtroom and were studiously ignored by the coroner and his jury have an important bearing upon the case, and I must begin my account with them. The first is that Sheriff Haddock, by his own admission, sent five extra deputies to West Natrona the day before the shooting. No explanation is made of this, but a surprise was sprung in the courtroom when John Clemens went on the witness stand. John Clemens is an Americanized Pole. In his case, Americanization seems to have consisted of his becoming a secret agent and scab herder for the coal operators. Though in the confidence of the strikers, he testified that he had been engaged by Louis Hicks, a wealthy Pittsburgh coal operator, to go to Natrona to induce strikers to go back to work in the mine. This also happened the day before the shooting. Clemens testified that he went to Natrona, met three friends of his who were on strike, and with them went up the hill to find two other men whom he hoped to induce to go back to work. He arrived at the little Jew store on the corner just in time to witness the shooting. The man who was killed was one of his companions, and both of the others who were with him were wounded. He escaped unhurt, but the bloody work he witnessed seems to have seriously shaken his Americanism, and his testimony at the inquest not only supported that of the striker witnesses, but furnished the clue to the cause of it all. The strike had to be broken. It was up to the deputies to break it. That's what they were there for. The strikers were peaceful, and so long as there was no trouble, they would probably stick together. Something had to be started so that Clemens and other agents who were probably on the job could get them to go back to work. Manison, chief of the deputies, had threatened early in the day to turn loose his dogs of war. About noon, some of the deputies went up the hill and went around in the yards of the little colony, firing off their revolvers. This was kept up for some time, and when asked why they were doing it, they said they were shooting at cats and dogs. One of the strikers telephoned to New Kensington for Mrs. Sellens, and about 3 p.m, she started for West Natrona with James Oates. In the meantime, a striker had been arrested for questioning the right of the deputies to fire shots around the yards where many children were playing. As Oates and Mrs. Sellens came up the hill, they met some deputies taking this man to the Tarentum jail. When they arrived at the store on the corner, they found everything quiet, but the atmosphere surcharged with excitement over the shooting and the arrest. 3 deputies with riot guns were loafing about the road. After learning the facts, Oates decided to go to Brackenridge and ask for warrants for the deputies who had been shooting. The shots had brought a few people to the hillside, among them Mr. Wilkins, a colored preacher from Natrona, and a boy with a camera. Mrs. Sellens asked this boy to take some pictures of the deputies with their riot guns, because this was the first day they had carried riot guns on the hill, and it looked ominous. Oates and Mr. Wilkins started down the hill, saying they would get warrants for the arrest of the deputies. The boy took several pictures that were offered in evidence at the inquest to prove that the deputies carried their riot guns and to show the peacefulness of the situation and the character of the small crowd that had gathered a few minutes before the murders. About the same time, Clemens and his 3 friends came up the road. The men with Clemens were Joseph Strzelecki, Anthony Sierkowski, and his son Teofil. Clemens says they sat down on some steps. They had learned that the organizers were going to seek warrants for the arrest of some of the deputies. The elder, Sierkowski, saw a deputy in the road who had struck him the day before with a club. He pointed him out, and his son Teofil went over to the deputy and asked him why he had struck his father. The deputy denied the accusation, and when the son called the father over to identify the man, the deputy struck the elder Sierkowski with his club, knocking him to the ground. From that moment, things happened with lightning swiftness. At the time, there were 80 or 90 people in the vicinity gathered about the little store in the dooryards nearby. There were about 12 men on the scene, including Clemens, the rest of the crowd being children of all ages and their mothers. Teofil Sierkowski went to the defense of his father and was attacked by other deputies headed by Chief Deputy Manison, who drove up at that moment in an automobile. At the same moment, a number of deputies came over the brow of the hill from the mine, headed by Norman Adams, the mine superintendent. As they came, they fired a volley into the crowd of women and children, most of whom were gathered about Fanny Sellens. Strzelecki, who was a man 56 years old but big and powerful, ran out into the road between these deputies and the women and children. As he ran, he was shot in the abdomen, but he staggered on until he met the advancing deputies. 2 of them attacked him with their clubs, beating him until he fell dying in the middle of the road. It was then that D.J. Riley, the deputy identified by Oates in the courtroom, ran up and fired the shots into the back of the dying man as he lay in the road. Strzelecki's skull was fractured and his body bore 5 gunshot wounds. While Riley was finishing the murder of Strzelecki in the roadway, Mrs. Sellens was trying to get the crowd of women and children into a yard for protection from the flying bullets. Norman Adams, the mine superintendent, seized a club from a deputy and ran up to her, cursing her as he came. He swung the club against her head, knocking her down. As she staggered to her feet, he called out to Deputy Pearson, who was advancing with a riot gun 20 feet away. "Kill the goddamn whore, son of a bitch." Pearson fired. Mrs. Sellens threw up her hands, turned half around, and fell. She fell halfway through a gateway. Deputy Joe Murray ran up and fired 3 shots into her prostrate body. Other deputies crowded around, striking at the body with clubs and the butts of their guns. The deputies continued firing upon the crowd, who scattered, terrified and screaming, in all directions until the roadway and yards were cleared. Then the deputies took up the body of Strzelecki, which was still showing signs of life, and threw it into the automobile. Adams went over to the body of Mrs. Sellens, took hold of her feet, and dragged her out into the road, tearing off her low shoes as he did so. Manison picked up her hat, put it on his head, danced a few steps, calling out, "I'm Mrs. Sellens now." Then they threw her body into the auto on top of the body of Strzelecki and drove down the hill to the office of the Allegheny Steel Company. Besides the two Sierkowskis, father and son, 3 other men had received bad gunshot wounds. One of the 3 was a steel mill worker on his way home from work. He was passing on the road below and received a bullet in the wrist from a deputy firing an automatic revolver. He described the deputy as spraying shots with his automatic as one would use a hose. Oates went to Squire Conway, Justice of the Peace at Brackenridge, and lodged a charge of murder against Joe Murray and 9 other deputies. Murray was the only one of the gunmen that he knew by name, and when he went with Conway to the office of the Allegheny Steel Company and demanded that he be allowed to enter the mill that he might identify the other deputies he had seen on the hill, he was refused admission. They told him they would give him Joe Murray, but not any of the others. Murray was placed under arrest. When the county officers who had been sent for arrived, they immediately went into a conference in the office of the Allegheny Steel Company. Chief Deputy Moore, who had been sent by Sheriff Haddock, then notified Squire Conway that if he issued any more warrants for deputies, he would be placed under arrest. Joe Murray was taken to Pittsburgh, charged with murder, but released at once under a nominal bail. Then began the campaign to whitewash the murderers, the culmination of which came at the coroner's inquest. 2 strikers, Joseph Katvash and Joseph Siraki, who were shot, went on the witness stand, identified the deputies who shot them, and were promptly arrested by Chief Deputy Moore, a tall, evil-looking, rat-eyed individual who superintended the intimidation practiced in the courtroom. He seemed to regret that he had not been at Natrona and had a share in the killing. From the beginning, it was apparent that the inquest had been framed to exonerate the gunmen. The company doctor who examined Fanny Sellens' body swore that he found but 1 gunshot wound and no other marks of violence in the face of a photograph taken in the morgue, which shows how horribly her head was battered, and 2 of the 4 gunshot wounds found on her body by the doctor who examined her for her son-in-law. This doctor was not allowed to testify. The other witnesses were the doctor, 2 county detectives who told of making investigations and reports which were on file but were not read in court, 8 deputies who went on the stand, and an answer to leading questions by Attorney Campbell told a stereotyped story without variation, though they occupied widely different positions, and all testified to being very busy all the time laying out the hunkies right and left. The official story, as told by these deputies, is that they fired to defend themselves from a shower of stones, bottles, and other missiles, but no explanation was offered as to how the alleged stone throwing began. The other witness was Norman Adams, superintendent of the mine and tax collector for the town of Natrona. When Adams went on the witness stand, he denied in a husky voice, without once lifting his head, that he knew anything whatever about the shooting, and asserted that he had remained in the mine office throughout the whole affair. His counsel and the coroner protected him from cross-examination, and he slunk back to his seat. But there are some signs so plain that anyone can recognize them, and anyone could see that he was as guilty as hell. Pearson admitted that he fired in the direction of Mrs. Sellens, but could not say whether he hit her, though he boasted of being a good shot and of having served with the American Expeditionary Forces. Asked what provocation the strikers had given him, he said they had often called him Bulldog Face. Joe Murray was not permitted on the stand because of the charge of murder lodged against him, but he was in the courtroom with his fellows, taunting the strikers with his air of bravado. Murray is the vilest-looking thug of them all and is a coal company gunman with a record. He is said to have killed two miners in the Westmoreland strike and 2 years ago threatened to get Fanny Sellens. If he is ever brought to trial in Allegheny County, it is certain that he will be vigorously defended by every official supposed to prosecute him, just as he is being protected by them now. The flimsy story of rioting told by the deputies was not thought of until after the Mine Workers Union made it clear that the murder of Fanny Sellens would not go unavenged. It is important to remember that not an arrest was made the day of the shooting, and though two persons were killed and five wounded, not one of the dozen deputies who took part in the killings could show any kind of wound or even bruise. Since the efforts made to secure the arrest of the deputies and Norman Adams, it became necessary to protect them by a countercharge of riot, and the deputies went up on the hill and picked out several strikers and arrested them upon the charge of rioting. James Oates was arrested on the charge of inciting to riot and is out on $1,000 bail. John Shaw, the president of the miners' union at Natrona, was also arrested upon the charge of inciting to riot, though he was a mile and a half away at the time of the shooting. I am satisfied from what I saw and learned from the case that not a stone was thrown and certainly not a shot fired by the strikers. I am also satisfied that it was a cold-blooded, premeditated attack and that they meant to murder Fanny Sellens and to terrorize the strikers so that the agents of Mr. Hicks and other capitalists interested in the mine and in the Allegheny Steel Company might induce the strikers to break ranks and go back to work. But the coroner's jury brought in a verdict that Fanny Sellens was killed by persons unknown while an attack was being made on deputies during a riot. They commended the deputies for their efficiency and took occasion to deplore the spread of Bolshevism. It was the verdict capital wanted and the Steel Trust needed. It made it possible for Mr. Gary to be flippant and sarcastic when he was asked by the Senate committee what the Steel Trust had to do with the killing of Fanny Sellens. I cannot believe that labor in America will allow the beasts who murdered Fanny Sellens and Joe Strzelecki to go unpunished. It is useless to hope that anyone in authority in the state of Pennsylvania will do anything but protect the murderers. Though it is seldom that seven such utterly degenerate types of professional gunmen as Manison, Murray, Riley, Pearson, Strobel, Ford, and Mann are found on the scene of one small strike. There are enough of the species scattered over this country today to make them a national menace that must be dealt with. There are some of the same kind capable of committing an atrocity as cold-blooded as that of Brackenridge. In every group of guards or troop of constabulary that goes into the field against strikers anywhere in America. The reason this is so is that guardlings to the last Norman Adams in any steel mill or coal mine in America know the kind of animal that is needed to do their bloody work and hire and train them to do it well. A year ago in Canada, the labor movement at Vancouver forced the Canadian government to prosecute a military agent who shot a labor organizer by calling a 24-hour general strike. The United Mine Workers of America, with their 450,000 members, could not only bring the murderers of Fanny Sellins before the bar of justice, but they could force the abolition forever of armed guards in the coal regions if they had courage enough to forget their sacred contracts and their fealty to an apathetic officialdom and come out of the pits for a few days on vacation. Now, that's the article as we published it in the Voice of Labor, and as we republished it 4 years later in Lawrence Labor, the only place that I know of that it has ever been printed. And the original story in the Voice of Labor resulted in the suppression of that paper, which was the labor organ of the Communist Labor Party immediately after the left-wing split, which out of which the Communist Party movement in America grew, the left-wing socialist split. And I brought the story back to New York, and John Reed, who was editor, thought we should make that the feature for the next week's issue. And I had the photograph of Fanny Sellins, just her head on the slab in the morgue, which a terrible, gruesome picture with her head all bashed in, just the way they took it when they brought her to the morgue after bringing her down from the hillside at Natroma. Her family had a picture taken of it and gave me a copy, one of the prints. So we published it with that picture covering the whole front page of Voice of Labor. And it had gotten out on the stands, and it hadn't gone into the mails when Mitchell Palmer's men raided the headquarters, seized all the copies we had, and they went around the city of New York and picked up everything they could find on the newsstands. We estimated that probably a couple hundred copies escaped them, and so far as I know, those 200 copies of the Voice of Labor are the only ones in existence. Today, we probably would have made a legal fight over the suppression of the paper on such grounds, because there was obviously, you can see there's nothing in the article except merely a report of something that happened, and the picture on the front page, cover, on the cover, was probably the thing that annoyed Palmer most, because it attracted a tremendous amount of attention, even the little circulation that it got. Another important thing about that incident was my first and only personal contact with Philip Murray. He was one of the witnesses in the courtroom that morning, and in contrast to all the other witnesses, all of whom, with the exception of James Oates, were miners and their families, people who lived over on the hill there and saw the shooting, Oates, being an organizer, the only other official went on the stand. All these witnesses were very courageous and picked out the and definitely identified the men who did the killing. Murray, who at that time was president of that district of the United Mine Workers and the responsible official in charge of the strike and the whole situation, and who had sent Oates and Fanny Sellins out there to organize the thing. He was the most frightened man on a witness stand that I've ever seen anywhere in my life. He evaded and alibied himself in every possible way for so as not to be connected with the incident at all. And later when I talked to him in his office, he was still suffering from the fright that he got from seeing these witnesses one after another. As fast as they testified in the courtroom, they were carried off to jail, charged with perjury, part of the prosecution's attempt to save their gunmen and discredit the strikers. That's from that time and the rest, throughout the rest of his career, whenever anything happened to Philip Murray or whenever he received any publicity, I could not help but think about that day in the courtroom at West Natrona and or Brackenridge. And I could not have very much respect for the man who afterwards became head of the CIO. The why the Voice of Labor was allowed to suspend after that, I don't know at this time, except that in those days we were not so given to making legal fights over everything that happened to us as we are today. We, especially the labor part of the movement, we were more inclined to meet the opposition with what pressure we could exert, economic pressure, and not bother too much about going into the courts. I think today we probably would have resisted the seizure of the paper and gotten out an injunction against Palmer and all that sort of thing.
Friends, I'm Eugene Barnett, one of the victims of the Centralia Conspiracy. The Centralia Conspiracy is an important case in labor history. There was a raid in Union Hall, the Lumber Workers Industrial Union of the IWW, on November the 11th, 1919, by a group of vigilantes organized by the Southwest Lumber Barons of the state trust had decided that the union was becoming too strong for them. But first I want to go back and tell you about how I began in the labor movement. I was born in the state of North Carolina, in the Blue Ridge Mountains. Born in a little log cabin where my daddy was born, my granddaddy was born there, and my great-granddaddy felled the trees and hewed the logs and built it. My ancestors came from England, moved up into the Blue Ridge Mountains because they had the theory the mountaineers are always free. That was one way of getting away from the class struggle. And that, there they live to this day. In 1898, when the coal barons of West Virginia had locked out the Union miners there who had organized and gone on strike in the national strike for the 8-hour day, my daddy was one of the men that was recruited from the hills of North Carolina to go out there and break the strike. About 40 families were moved out there. The superintendent from the mine had been born down there in North Carolina. He'd gone to school with my daddy, and he knew that the people down there knew nothing about unions, new conditions in industry, steel strike breakers. Knowing nothing of it and having no union ideas, they were just what they wanted. So he came there to recruit the strike breakers. When we got out in West Virginia, we found the coal miners camped on a gravel bar on the Kentucky side of Tug River. The river was the line between West Virginia and Kentucky. An injunction had been obtained and they'd been forced out of the state. So there they were camped. We could hear their children crying all day long. It seemed they cried incessantly. So I asked another kid who was playing with me there one day, a boy about my own age, said, why do those kids cry all the time? Seem like they cry all the time. Well, he said, they're hungry. They don't get anything to eat. Their daddy joined that old union, and it don't give them anything. All they get's one loaf of bread a week. That's all they got. And that seemed to be the opinion of the grown-ups around there, too. They seemed to think the same way. A little later, when the company preacher there, owned by the company like everything else in the camp, took up a collection for the starving Chinese and sent a boxcar load of groceries away that he had bought out of the company store, where groceries were three times as high as they were in Charleston or New York or some other place outside the jurisdiction of the coal company. I asked my daddy why he didn't donate that to the kids over across the river. Well, he said their daddies were no count. They could have had the job he had, but they wouldn't work. And so that settled it. I was just a kid, and I couldn't argue with him about it, but it didn't seem right to me. I could hear those kids crying. I knew they was hungry. I figured that they should have something to eat. I couldn't hear the Chinese crying over in China. And I doubt now whether that ever got out of the state of West Virginia. Of course, at that time, just being a kid, I couldn't reason that far. However, seeing things since the way it goes, why, I doubt very much whether it ever reached the Chinese. But at any rate, my daddy put me to work in the mine and bought me a cap, bought the smallest they had in the company store, pinned it up with a mule shoe nail so it was small enough to fit me, hold a lamp on my head, put me to work about a mile underground. I was tending a trap door that regulated the air currents in the mine. Of course, it would take 5 or 6 hours when the miners fired their shots for the smoke to clear out. But you didn't wait for that smoke to clear out. You went to work. The superintendent said that helped to fan the smoke out. So that was another way of economizing on fans. So we'd go to work in the mines before daylight, and we'd come out after dark. For that kind of work, I got 75 cents a day. The camp there was honeycombed with Pinkerton and Bald and Phelps detectives. Once in a while, a union organizer would drift in, trying to reorganize the district. And in a few days, it'd be found out that he was an organizer, and they'd find him hanging on a beech tree out in front of the company store. Or perhaps some Baldwin Phelps or Pinkerton would knock him on the head out in the railroad track, kill him. If it was in broad daylight and too many witnesses, well, the detective would probably have to leave camp for 2 or 3 weeks and come back. No one was ever arrested for it. No trials were ever held for anyone that was killed in that way, and there was plenty of them killed while we were there. On one occasion, Mother Jones came in there, stood on the mail crane where the passenger train came through and took the mail on the fly, made a speech to the miners, and she was ridden out of camp on a rail. In the 6 years that I was there, I heard enough of unionism, in spite of the detectives, to find out a little about it and want to get where there was a union. So I ran away and went to Pennsylvania. I landed up there in Somerset County, Jerome, Pennsylvania. Went to work in the mines there. It was still a non-union field, but it was close enough to the union field that conditions were better. The coal companies, fearing the union, had improved conditions in order to keep it out. So we had the 8-hour day. They had fans there to take the air out of the mines. And they paid $2.34 a day for the same work that I'd done down in West Virginia for 75 cents a day. So I thought if it improved conditions that much, getting close to a union field, it'd really be heaven if it got where they had a union. So I moved again. I landed in Shadyside, Ohio. I went to work in the Putney mine there and joined the union. From that time on, I've been a union man. I liked the way they walked around and said what they thought. They could go around with their head up like an American man should and speak their mind. They didn't have to worry about who was listening to them and glance over their shoulder every time they started to say something to see if there's someone listening, and they might be shot down as soon as night come, or even before, as often happened in West Virginia. So living like American men, why, that became my religion. I believed in it. I believed in the union. I tried to spread it everywhere I went. I wasn't content to just be a card packer walking around with a union card in my pocket and capitalistic ideas in my head. I wanted to help do something. I wanted to help build the union and spread it in all industry, not only in my own industry. I felt it was good for the whole working class, and I worked to that end. And any time I was asked to serve on a pit committee or a grievance committee or or as president of my local, or anything like that. I accepted the office and served to the best of my ability. I moved on from one coal camp to another, and wherever I went, I found that the workers get just what their union is strong enough to take for them. Makes no difference what the law is, makes no difference what party's in power, or anything else. If you haven't got a union strong enough to enforce the law and enforce your demands, you get absolutely nothing. In Colorado, the 8-hour day was on the statute books for 11 years before it was enforced in the mines, and we didn't get it until our union was strong enough to enforce the law and take it for us. The same thing was true up in the Northwest when I came on out there in 1910. I found that the loggers up in the state of Washington were working 11 hours a day. They were sleeping 40 men in a bunkhouse, double-decked bunks on the wall, just one little window, just one sash, not really a window, just a half a window for a bunkhouse. You'd open the door and open that one sash, and that's all the ventilation you got. You worked all day in the rain. You came in at night and hung your old soggy clothes up around the one stove in the center of the room with wires going out from it in all directions like a spider web, and they hung there and steamed all night. And you slept there in that steam. That's the only bath you got. There was no other facilities for one. You got your steam bath there every night. There was no place to wash your clothes. If you wanted to wash up, the only thing you could do was go out and hunt up an old coal oil can on Sunday and boil up your clothes like a hobo down in the jungle. There was no place to wash, no place to take care of them. If you moved from one camp to another, you had to go with your roll of blankets on your back. You looked like a bunch of snails going down the highway. So when the loggers began organizing, trying to build an industrial union for to do away with those conditions, I was strong for it. And I did everything I could to further the union idea and help build it up. In 1919, when the lumber barons in Centralia decided to run the union out of Centralia, I was secretary of the United Mine Workers local at Capaya, 11 miles out of Centralia. And they held a meeting in the Elks Club there about 3 weeks prior to this raid and selected a committee. They gave F.B. Hubbard, the president of the Southwest Washington Lumbermen's Association, their power to create a secret committee to devise ways and means of running this union out of town. And they were so sure of themselves that they went and published an item in the daily newspaper there telling of this, telling how he had been empowered to select his own committee for this purpose. When I heard of that, I went down and I got 40 copies of that paper. And I marked the article, and I put them in mailboxes, in farmers' mailboxes out between there and the mine, to acquaint the farmers with what was going to happen. Because I figured that the farmers, seeing this trouble coming, would try to head it off, if for no other reason, for the sake of keeping down their taxes. Because it was plain to anyone, if there was trouble there, well, there was going to be trials and court procedure and so forth that would raise their taxes or put their county in debt. So I figured from that angle, if for no other, they might protest. On November the 11th, the day the raid occurred, I was in town that afternoon. Happened to go in by accident. I'd even forgot that it was Armistice Day. I'd been out coyote hunting out there in the hills the previous few days because we were on strike, the National Coal Strike in 1919. It began November the 1st, and I was out on that. All the miners were on a strike at that time. So I hadn't been taking much interest in what was going on. I hadn't been keeping track of the days. I was going out and having some fun with my hounds out in the woods, chasing coyotes, enjoying myself, enjoying a vacation, which a worker seldom gets, only when he is on a strike or something like that. Of course, it was a vacation without pay, but nevertheless, I was enjoying it. So I went into town that day and was visiting with a friend in a hotel adjoining this hall when the raid occurred. I saw the parade come up the opposite side of the street. I saw them park two army trucks out there, which they planned to load the men that they took out of the hall in, as they had done on a previous occasion some months before when they raided another hall about two blocks from there. They parked an army truck there, and they took the men out of the hall and lifted them by their ears like they were loading hogs, loaded them into this truck. Took them down between Centralia and Chehalis and forced them to run the gauntlet. run between two lines of men armed with gas pipes and clubs and rubber hose or whatever they had. If they had nothing else, they'd take a kick at them or slug them with their fists. Use whatever weapon they had for to beat them up and run them out. Told them to go on towards Chehalis and keep on a-going, not to come back. So they planned the same thing for this day. Before ever the trouble started, I saw men in the ranks of this parade with ropes and guns and gas pipes. So I knew what was coming. You could feel it in the air. You didn't even have to see it. There was a tensity there that you could absolutely feel. They marched on up to the next corner above the hall and came back on the side next to it and were bunched up by Lieutenant Fred Cormier, the man there that ran a confectionery store down on Main Street. He was marshal of the day and mounted on horseback. He gave the order, bunch up, men, and they halted in front of the place and bunched up. The men in the front lines of this contingent turned around and faced the hall. Some of them stood in a crouched position, like a runner waiting for the signal to make his start, and were absolutely turned around in rank. As the marshal of the day rode on back along the ranks, giving orders, these fellows who had turned around in ranks would make false starts. It wasn't the right order. They were waiting for a given order, and when it came, Fred Cormier, the marshal of the day, blew a whistle, and they converged on the door of that hall from both ends of this contingent that had stopped there. Came in a wedge shape right for the door, and they smashed the doors and windows, and the first man that stepped inside the hall was shot down. When I saw them attack the place, I thought there was going to be a fight. I didn't know that anyone in the hall had guns. I'd been in there a short time before, and I hadn't seen any guns. There were only four or five men in the hall, so it was as much a surprise to me as to anyone when the shooting started. When I saw them make the attack, I threw my coat, pulled it off and threw it on a sewing machine in the lobby of the hotel and started for the door. But before I reached the door, the shooting started, so I turned around and walked back over to where I threw my coat. I had intended to go out and take part in the fight. I figured there'd be a fight, and I was going to take my beating along with the rest of the boys. But before I got there, the shooting started. Then they started coming into the hotel, going through into the back to break through a partition door back there to come into the back of the hall, try to get in behind the boys and surround them. They were coming in there with guns. One fellow had a hand axe, so they came in and they broke this door with the hand axe to go in through. While they were coming in, there was a man came in there who owned a grocery store there, Bill Scales. He's dying with a cancer up there now. Got one eye eat out and his ear off. I saw him not so long ago. And he came in through there, and I was acquainted with him because I'd traded at his store at one time. He had a grocery store there in town. So I told him to warn these fellows to be careful with the guns because the proprietor's wife had gone into the back. And the way they were coming in there, their mouths drawn like horsehairs and everything, you could see that they were scared, and I figured if even a chipmunk moved, why, they'd be apt to shoot. So I told him to tell him to be careful with those guns. He looked at me, but he didn't make any reply. So the next fella come in, a big strapping young fella in sailor's uniform and with a big navy coat. I told him myself to be careful that there's a lady back there. He looked at me and made no reply, but went on through. So when they broke through in there, they found that the boys had ran out the back of the hall. Wesley Everest, the man who had been shooting from inside the hall, was a returned soldier himself. He was wearing his uniform that day, and he was shooting with a gun that he had brought back from France. He'd been cited for bravery over there and had been denied his medal because they had found that he was a radical. He told the boys that day, he said, I fought for democracy in France, and I'm going to fight for it here. He said, the first man that comes in this hall, he's going to get it. So he made his stand right in the middle of the floor that day. After he ran out the back, they chased him, shooting at him and him shooting back at them. They ran about a quarter of a mile from there, ran down to the Skookumchuck River. He started to wade the river, but for some reason or other, he turned around and come back. Came back on the bank, and he said, if there's an officer in the bunch, I'll surrender. If there's not, lay off of him. They attacked him, and he killed Dale Hubbard down there. nephew of the president of the Southwest Washington Lumber Association. Then his gun jammed, and they overpowered him. He threw his gun in the river when it jammed and started to fight with his fist, but he was no match for 8 or 10 men, so they overpowered him, put a hair rope around his neck, tied it behind an automobile, and drug him back into town behind an automobile. They drug him down within a half a block of the city jail and hung him on a telephone pole. There was people there clawing at him. They were jabbing him with bayonets, and no one in that crowd except one little woman that weighed about 90 pounds had nerve enough to say anything or do anything. Her daddy was a union man, a railroad man. So she slapped some of their faces, told them what a bunch of cowards they were, and pulled him down. They took him and threw him in the corridor of the jail. He was unconscious from the beating and dragging and everything, and he lay there all afternoon. That night, about 8 o'clock, the mayor of the city turned the lights out all over the town. While it was in darkness, the mob went in and got him again. A man who was said to be a prominent doctor there used a razor on him, castrated him, like you would an alley cat, if you'd be that cruel. Then he washed his hands on the lawn of Timberman's lawn there at a hydrant, and they went on down and hung him on a wagon bridge that crosses the Chehalis River, about a mile out of town. Later in the night, they came back, turned their headlights on the body, shot it full of holes, cut the rope, and let him fall in the river. Then they divided up the rope among themselves as souvenirs. I was back there a few years ago, and they told me that some of the businessmen there still have their piece of rope. They show it around to special friends once in a while, piece of rope that Wesley Everest was hung with. 3 days later, the assistant attorney general came over there, and he said, "We've got to get that body." He said, "If the unions get a hold of it, mutilated the way it is, and get pictures of it in the union record and the other labor papers, why, they'll have us pictured as a bunch of morons all over the United States. He said, "We've got to get it." So they drug the river and got the body, brought it up there, took some of his fellow workers out of the city jail there, and forced them to bury him out there along the railroad. That was the unknown soldier's grave he got for fighting for democracy here in his own land, fighting for the right of the workers to join a union of their own choice without the boss's permission, to do away with rotten conditions and long hours and low wages. They don't care a darn about the worker. All this noise about the unknown soldier's grave and all that stuff is just a lot of poppycock. Whenever a man makes a fight for his own rights or for his own interests, why, any old grave's good enough for him. They'd even consider a dog better, especially if it happened to be their own dog. After that, every man in that community that was considered anywhere sympathetic to the organization at all was arrested and thrown into jail on one pretext or another. Mrs. McAllister, the proprietor's wife, in whose hotel I was when this happened, was arrested and placed in jail, and she was kept there for 27 days trying to make her say that I wasn't in there. She was an old lady born in Missouri. She was 60-odd years old, but still they kept her in jail 67 days trying to make her lie. But she was made out of too stern a stuff. Centralia was not an isolated case. There's cases like this coming up every day. We're on the eve of another world war now, and there'll be plenty of Centralias come up as the thing goes on and the struggle becomes more intense. So I want to say to you here tonight, regardless of everything else, build your union. That's where your real defense is. That's the one thing that can protect you. Up in the state of Washington now, we have a case similar to Centralia, the law case up there in Aberdeen. The man was at his union meeting and his wife was murdered. He's been tried in every way that they could to frame him for the murder of his own wife, even to the extent of going to Seattle and representing themselves as FBI agents to get possession of his suit of clothes. But fortunately, he had sent this suit to the FBI himself before they got a hold of it. So they haven't been able to frame him, but they haven't gave up their efforts. They're still trying. And there'll be other cases. There's cases here in California, King Ramsey and Connor, and others similar all over the country. And the only thing that can protect these men and that can protect the ones who stand out in the forefront of labor is the labor organizations themselves. So hold your unions together and build them bigger and build them stronger. It is your one hope and your one salvation. Everything that we've got in this world today that is any good has been won by the unions and have been won by struggle and blood. Someone has had to pay for it. You don't get anything for nothing. If you do, it isn't worth having. So I say to you once more, to fight for your union, be loyal to it, and build it up.
Thank you.